to change its state, moving, for instance, from a non-dividing to a dividing state. Src was a prototypical kinase, although a kinase on hyperdrive. The protein made by the viral Src gene was so potent and hyperactive that it phosphorylated anything and everything around it, including many crucial proteins in the cell. Src worked by unleashing an indiscriminate volley of phosphorylation, throwing on dozens of molecular switches. In Src's case, the activated series of proteins eventually impinged on proteins that controlled cell division. Src thus forcibly induced a cell to change its state from non-dividing to dividing, ultimately inducing accelerated mitosis, the hallmark of cancer. By the late 1970s, the combined efforts of biochemists and tumor virologists had produced a relatively simple view of Src's ability to transform cells. Rouse sarcoma virus caused cancer in chickens by introducing into cells a gene, Src, that encoded a hyperactive, over-exuberant kinase. This kinase turned on a cascade of cellular signals to divide relentlessly. All of this represented beautiful, careful, meticulously crafted work. But with no human cancer retroviruses in the study, none of this research seemed relevant immediately to human cancers. Yet the indefatigable Temin still felt that viral Src would solve the mystery of human cancers. In Temin's mind, there was one riddle yet to be solved: the evolutionary origin of the Src gene. How might a virus have acquired a gene with such potent, disturbing qualities? Was Src a viral kinase gone berserk? Or was it a kinase that the virus had constructed out of bits of other genes, like a cobbled-together bomb? Evolution, Temin knew, could build new genes out of old genes. But where had Rouse sarcoma virus found the necessary components of a gene to make a chicken cell cancerous? At the University of California in San Francisco, UCSF, in a building perched high on one of the city's hills, a virologist named J. Michael Bishop became preoccupied with the evolutionary origin of viral Src. Born in rural Pennsylvania, where his father had been a Lutheran minister, Bishop had studied history at Gettysburg College, then drastically altered his trajectory to attend Harvard Medical School. After a residency at Massachusetts General Hospital, he had trained as a virologist. In the 1960s, Bishop had moved to UCSF to set up a lab to explore viruses. UCSF was then a little-known backwater medical school. Bishop's shared office occupied a sliver of space at the edge of the building, a room so cramped and narrow that his office mate had to stand up to let him through to his desk. In the summer of 1969, when a lanky, self-assured researcher from the NIH, Harold Varmus, then on a hiking trip in California, knocked on Bishop's office door to ask if he might join the lab to study retroviruses, there was hardly any standing room at all. Varmus had come to California seeking adventure. A former graduate student in literature, he had become enthralled by medicine, obtained his MD at Columbia University in New York, then learned virology at the NIH. Like Bishop, he was also an academic itinerant, wandering from medieval literature to medicine to virology. Lewis Carroll's Hunting of the Snark tells the story of a motley crew of hunters that launch an agonizing journey to trap a deranged, invisible creature called the Snark. That hunt goes awfully wrong. Unpromisingly, as Varmus and Bishop set off to understand the origins of the Src gene in the early 1970s, other scientists nicknamed the project The Hunting of the Src. Varmus and Bishop launched their hunt using a simple technique, a method invented in part by Saul Spiegelman in the 1960s. Their goal was to find cellular genes that were distantly similar to the viral Src gene, and thus find Src's evolutionary precursors. DNA molecules typically exist as paired, complementary strands, like yin and yang, that are stuck together by powerful molecular forces. Each strand, if separated, can thus stick to another strand that is complementary in structure. If one molecule of DNA is tagged with radioactivity, it will seek out its complementary molecule in a mixture and stick to it, thereby imparting radioactivity to the second molecule. The sticking ability can be measured by the amount of radioactivity. In the mid-1970s, Bishop and Varmus began to use the viral Src gene to hunt for its homologs, using this sticking reaction. Src was a viral gene, and they expected to find only fragments or pieces of Src in normal cells, ancestors and distant relatives of the cancer-causing Src gene. But the hunt soon took a mystifying turn. When Varmus and Bishop looked in normal cells, they did not find a genetic third or fifth cousin of Src. They found a nearly identical version of viral Src lodged firmly in the normal cell's genome. Varmus and Bishop, working with Deborah Spector and Dominique Stalen, probed more cells, and again the Src gene appeared in them, in duck cells, quail cells, and geese cells. Closely related homologs of the Src gene were strewn all over the bird kingdom. Each time Varmus's team looked up or down an evolutionary branch, they found some variant of Src staring back. Soon the UCSF group was racing through multiple species to look for homologs of Src. They found Src in the cells of pheasants, turkeys, mice, rabbits, and fish. Cells from a newborn emu at the Sacramento Zoo had Src. So did sheep and cows. Most important, so did human cells. Src, Varmus wrote in a letter in 1976, is everywhere. But the Src gene that existed in normal cells was not identical to the viral Src. When Hidesaburo Hanafusa, a Japanese virologist at Rockefeller University in New York, compared the viral Src gene to the normal cellular Src gene, he found a crucial difference in the genetic code between the two forms of Src. Viral Src carried mutations that dramatically affected its function. Viral Src protein, as Erickson had found in Colorado, was a disturbed, hyperactive kinase that relentlessly tagged proteins with phosphate groups and thus provided a perpetually blaring on signal for cell division. Cellular Src protein possessed the same kinase activity, but it was far less hyperactive. In contrast to viral Src, it was tightly regulated, turned on and turned off during cell division. The viral Src protein, in contrast, was a permanently activated switch, an automaton, as Erickson described it, that had turned the cell into a dividing machine. Viral Src, the cancer-causing gene, was cellular Src on overdrive. A theory began to convulse out of these results, a theory so magnificent and powerful that it would explain decades of disparate observations in a single swoop. Perhaps Src, the precursor to the cancer-causing gene, was endogenous to the cell. Perhaps viral Src had evolved out of cellular Src. Retrovirologists had long believed that the virus had introduced an activated Src into normal cells to transform them into malignant cells. But the Src gene had not originated in the virus. It had originated from a precursor gene that existed in a cell, in all cells. Cancer biology's decades-long hunt had started with a chicken and ended, metaphorically, in the egg, in a progenitor gene present in all human cells. Rouse's sarcoma virus, then, was the product of an incredible evolutionary accident. Retroviruses, Temin had shown, shuttle constantly out of the cell's genome, RNA to DNA to RNA. During this cycling, they can pick up pieces of the cell's genes and carry them, like barnacles, from one cell to another. Rouse's sarcoma virus had likely picked up an activated sarc gene from a cancer cell and carried it in the viral genome, creating more cancer. The virus, in effect, was no more than an accidental courier for a gene that had originated in a cancer cell, a parasite parasitized by cancer. Rouse had been wrong, but spectacularly wrong. Viruses did cause cancer, but they did so, typically, by tampering with genes that originate in cells. Science is often described as an iterative and cumulative process, a puzzle solved piece by piece, with each piece contributing a few hazy pixels of a much larger picture. But the arrival of a truly powerful new theory in science often feels far from iterative. Rather than explain one observation or phenomenon in a single pixelated step, an entire field of observations suddenly seems to crystallize into a perfect whole. The effect is almost like watching a puzzle solve itself. Varmus and Bishop's experiments had precisely such a crystallizing, zippering effect on cancer genetics. The crucial implication of the Varmus and Bishop experiment was that a precursor of a cancer-causing gene, the proto-oncogene, as Bishop and Varmus called it, was a normal cellular gene. Mutations induced by chemicals or X-rays caused cancer not by inserting foreign genes into cells, but by activating such endogenous proto-oncogenes. Nature, Rouse wrote in 1966, sometimes seems possessed of a sardonic humor. And the final lesson of Rouse's sarcoma virus had been its most sardonic by far. For nearly six decades, the Rouse virus had seduced biologists, Spiegelman most sadly among them, down a false path. Yet the false path had ultimately circled back to the right destination, from viral sarc toward cellular sarc, and to the notion of internal proto-oncogenes sitting omnipresently in the normal cell's genome. In Lewis Carroll's poem, when the hunters finally capture the deceptive snark, it reveals itself not to be a foreign beast, but one of the human hunters sent to trap it. And so it had turned out with cancer. Cancer genes came from within the human genome. Indeed, the Greeks had been peculiarly prescient yet again in their use of the term oncus. Cancer was intrinsically loaded in our genome, awaiting activation. We were destined to carry this fatal burden in our genes, our own genetic oncus. Varmus and Bishop were awarded the Nobel Prize for their discovery of the cellular origins of retroviral oncogenes in 1989. At the banquet in Stockholm, Varmus, recalling his former life as a student of literature, read lines from the epic poem Beowulf, recapitulating the slaying of the dragon in that story. "We have not slain our enemy, the cancer cell, or figuratively torn the limbs from his body," Varmus said. "In our adventures, we have only seen our monster more clearly and described his scales and fangs in new ways, ways that reveal a cancer cell to be, like Grendel, a distorted version of our normal selves." The Wind in the Trees. The fine, fine wind that takes its course through the chaos of the world, like a fine and exquisite chisel, a wedge blade inserted. D.H. Lawrence. The developments of the summer of 1976 drastically reorganized the universe of cancer biology, returning genes again to its center. Harold Varmus and Michael Bishop's proto-oncogene theory provided the first cogent and comprehensive theory of carcinogenesis. The theory explained how radiation, soot, and cigarette smoke, diverse and seemingly unrelated insults, could all initiate cancer by mutating and thus activating precursor oncogenes within the cell. The theory made sense of Bruce Ames's peculiar correlation between carcinogens and mutagens, chemicals that cause mutations in DNA, produce cancers because they alter cellular proto-oncogenes. The theory clarified why the same kind of cancer might arise in smokers and non-smokers, albeit at different rates. Both smokers and non-smokers have the same proto-oncogenes in their cells, but smokers develop cancer at a higher rate because carcinogens in tobacco increase the mutation rate of these genes. But what did human cancer genes look like? Tumor virologists had found SARC in viruses and then in cells, but surely other endogenous proto-oncogenes were strewn about in the human cellular genome. Genetics has two distinct ways to see genes. The first is structural. Genes can be envisioned as physical structures, pieces of DNA lined up along chromosomes, just as Morgan and Fleming had first envisioned them. The second is functional. Genes can be imagined, a la Mendel, as the inheritance of traits that move from one generation to the next. In the decade between 1970 and 1980, cancer genetics would begin to see cancer-causing genes in these two lights. Each distinct vision would enhance the mechanistic understanding of carcinogenesis, bringing the field closer and closer to an understanding of the core molecular aberration in human cancers. Structure, anatomy, came first. In 1973, as Varmus and Bishop were launching their initial studies on SARC, a hematologist in Chicago, Janet Rowley, saw a human cancer gene in a physical form. Rowley's specialty was studying the staining patterns of chromosomes in cells in order to locate chromosomal abnormalities in cancer cells. Chromosome staining, the technique she had perfected, is as much an art as a science. It is also an oddly anachronistic art, like painting with tempera in an age of digital prints. At a time when cancer genetics was zooming off to explore the world of RNA, tumor viruses, and oncogenes, Rowley was intent on dragging the discipline back to its roots, to Boveri's and Fleming's chromosomes dyed in blue. Piling anachronism upon anachronism, the cancer she had chosen to study was chronic myelogenous leukemia, CML, Bennett's infamous suppuration of blood. Rowley's study was built on prior work by a duo of pathologists from Philadelphia who had also studied CML. In the late 1950s, Peter Nowell and David Hungerford had found an unusual chromosomal pattern in this form of leukemia. The cancer cells bore one consistently shortened chromosome. Human cells have 46 chromosomes, 23 matched pairs, one inherited from each parent. In CML cells, Nowell found that one copy of the 22nd chromosome had its head lopped off. Nowell called the abnormality the Philadelphia chromosome, after the place of its discovery. But Nowell and Hungerford could not understand where the decapitated chromosome had come from, or where its missing head had gone. Rowley, following this study, began to trace the headless chromosome in her CML cells. By laying out exquisitely stained photographs of CML chromosomes enlarged thousands of times, she typically spread them on her dining table and then leaned into the pictures, hunting for the missing pieces of the infamous Philadelphia chromosome, Rowley found a pattern. The missing head of chromosome 22 had attached itself elsewhere, to the tip of chromosome 9. And a piece of chromosome 9 had conversely attached itself to chromosome 22. This genetic event was termed a translocation, the flip-flop transposition of two pieces of chromosomes. Rowley examined case after case of CML patients. In every single case, she found this same translocation in the cells. Chromosomal abnormalities in cancer cells had been known since the days of von Hanselmann and Boveri. But Rowley's results argued a much more profound point. Cancer was not disorganized chromosomal chaos. It was organized chromosomal chaos. Specific and identical mutations existed in particular forms of cancer. Chromosomal translocations can create new genes called chimeras by fusing two genes formerly located on two different chromosomes. The head of chromosome 9, say, fused with the tail of a gene in chromosome 13. The CML translocation, Rowley postulated, had created such a chimera. Rowley did not know the identity or function of this new chimeric monster, but she had demonstrated that a novel, unique genetic alteration, later found to be an oncogene, could exist in a human cancer cell, revealing itself purely by virtue of an aberrant chromosome structure. In Houston, Alfred Knudsen, a Caltech-trained geneticist, also saw a human cancer-causing gene in the early 1970s, although in yet another distinct sense. Rowley had visualized cancer-causing genes by studying the physical structure of the cancer cell's chromosomes. Knudsen concentrated monastically on the function of a gene. Genes are units of inheritance. They shuttle properties, traits, from one generation to the next. If genes cause cancer, Knudsen reasoned, then he might capture a pattern in the inheritance of cancer. Much as Mendel had captured the idea of a gene by studying the inheritance of flower color or plant height in peas. In 1969, Knudsen moved to the MD Anderson Cancer Center in Texas, where Freireich had set up a booming clinical center for childhood cancers. Knudsen needed a model cancer, a hereditary malignancy, whose underlying patterns of inheritance would reveal how cancer-causing genes worked. The natural choice was retinoblastoma, the odd, rare variant of eye cancer that De Gouveia had identified in Brazil, with its striking tendency to erupt in the same family across generations. Retinoblastoma is a particularly tragic form of cancer, not just because it assaults children, but because it assaults the quintessential organ of childhood. The tumor grows in the eye. Afflicted children are sometimes diagnosed when the world around them begins to blur and fade, but occasionally, the cancer is incidentally found in a child's photograph when the eye, lit by a camera flash, glows eerily like a cat's eyes in lamplight, revealing the tumor buried behind the lens. Left untreated, the tumor will crawl backward from the eye socket into the optic nerve and then climb into the brain. The primary methods of treatment are to sear the tumor with high doses of gamma radiation or to enucleate the eye surgically, leaving behind an empty socket. Retinoblastoma has two distinct variants, an inherited familial form and a sporadic form. De Gouveia had identified the familial form. Children who suffer from this familial or inherited form may carry strong family histories of the disease, fathers, mothers, cousins, siblings, and kindred affected, and they typically develop tumors in both eyes, as in De Gouveia's case from Rio. But the tumor also arises in children with no family history of the disease. Children with this sporadic form never carry a history in the family and always have a tumor in only one eye. The pattern of inheritance intrigued Knudsen. He wondered whether he could discern a subtle difference in the development of cancer between the sporadic and the inherited versions using mathematical analyses. He performed the simplest of experiments. He grouped children with the sporadic form into one cohort and children with the familial form in a second. And sifting through old hospital records, Knudsen tabulated the ages in which the disease struck the two groups, then plotted them as two curves. Intriguingly, he found that the two cohorts developed the cancers at different velocities, In inherited retinoblastoma, cancer onset was rapid, with diagnosis typically 2 to 6 months after birth. Sporadic retinoblastoma typically appeared 2 to 4 years after birth. But why did the same disease move with different velocities in different children? Knudsen used the numbers and simple equations borrowed from physics and probability theory to model the development of the cancer in the two cohorts. He found that the data fit a simple model. In children with the inherited form of retinoblastoma, only one genetic change was required to develop the cancer. Children with the sporadic form required 2 genetic changes. This raised another puzzling question. Why was only one genetic change needed to unleash cancer in the familial case, while 2 changes were needed in the sporadic form? Knudsen perceived a simple, beautiful explanation. The number 2, he recalled, is the geneticist's favorite number. Every normal human cell has 2 copies of each chromosome, and thus 2 copies of every gene. Every normal cell must have 2 normal copies of the retinoblastoma gene, RB. To develop sporadic retinoblastoma, Knudsen postulated, both copies of the gene needed to be inactivated through a mutation in each copy of the RB gene. Hence, sporadic retinoblastoma develops at later ages because 2 independent mutations have to accumulate in the same cell. Children with the inherited form of retinoblastoma, in contrast, are born with a defective copy of RB. In their cells, one gene copy is already defective, and only a single additional genetic mutation is needed before the cell senses the change and begins to divide. These children are thus predisposed to the cancer, and they develop cancer faster, producing the rapid velocity tumors that Knudsen saw in his statistical charts. Knudsen called this the two-hit hypothesis of cancer. For certain cancer-causing genes, 2 mutational hits were needed to provoke cell division and thus produce cancer. Knudsen's two-hit theory was a powerful explanation for the inheritance pattern of retinoblastoma, but at first glance it seemed at odds with the initial molecular understanding of cancer. The SARC gene, recall, requires a single activated copy to provoke uncontrolled cell division. Knudsen's gene required 2. Why was a single mutation in SARC sufficient to provoke cell division, while 2 were required for RB? The answer lies in the function of the 2 genes. SARC activates a function in cell division. The mutation in SARC, as Ray Erickson and Hidesaburo Hanafusa had discovered, creates a cellular protein that is unable to extinguish its function, an insatiable hyperactive kinase on overdrive that provokes perpetual cell division. Knudsen's gene, RB, performs the opposite function. It suppresses cell proliferation, and it is the inactivation of such a gene, by virtue of 2 hits, that unleashes cell division. RB, then, is a cancer suppressor gene, the functional opposite of SARC, an anti-oncogene, as Knudsen called it. 2 classes of genes are apparently critical in the origin of the cancers of children, he wrote. One class, that of oncogenes, acts by virtue of abnormal or elevated activity. The other class, that of anti-oncogenes, or tumor suppressors, is recessive in oncogenesis. Cancer results when both normal copies have been mutated or deleted. Some persons carry one such mutation in the germline and are highly susceptible to tumor because only one somatic event is necessary. Some children, even though carrying no such mutation in the germline, can acquire tumor as a result of 2 somatic events. It was an exquisitely astute hypothesis, spun remarkably out of statistical reasoning alone. Knudsen did not know the molecular identity of his phantasmic anti-oncogenes. He had never looked at a cancer cell to see these genes. He had never performed a biological experiment to pin down RB. Like Mendel, Knudsen knew his genes only in a statistical sense. He had inferred them, as he put it, as one might infer the wind from the movement of the trees. By the late 1970s, Varmus, Bishop, and Knudsen could begin to describe the core molecular aberration of the cancer cell, stitching together the coordinated actions of oncogenes and anti-oncogenes. Cancer genes, Knudsen proposed, came in two flavors. Positive genes, such as SARC, are mutant activated versions of normal cellular genes. In normal cells, these genes accelerate cell division, but only when the cell receives an appropriate growth signal. In their mutant form, these genes are driven into perpetual hyperactivity, unleashing cell division beyond control. An activated proto-oncogene, to use Bishop's analogy, is a jammed accelerator in a car. A cell with such a jammed accelerator careens down the path of cell division, unable to cease mitosis, dividing and dividing again relentlessly. Negative genes, such as RB, suppress cell division. In normal cells, these anti-oncogenes, or tumor suppressor genes, provide the brakes to cellular proliferation, shutting down cell division when the cell receives appropriate signals. In cancer cells, these brakes have been inactivated by mutations. In cells with missing brakes, to use Bishop's analogy again, the stop signals for mitosis can no longer be registered. Again, the cell divides and keeps dividing, defying all signals to stop. Both abnormalities, activated proto-oncogenes and inactivated tumor suppressors, jammed accelerators, and missing brakes, represent the core molecular defects in the cancer cell. Bishop, Knudsen, and Varmus did not know how many such defects were ultimately needed to cause human cancers. But a confluence of them, they postulated, causes cancer. A risky prediction. They see only their own shadows, or the shadows of one another, which the fire throws on the opposite wall of the cave. Plato. The philosopher of science, Karl Popper, coined the term risky prediction to describe the process by which scientists verify untested theories. Good theories, Popper proposed, generate risky predictions. They presage an unanticipated fact or event that runs a real risk of not occurring or being proven incorrect. When this unanticipated fact proves true, or the event does occur, the theory gains credibility and robustness. Newton's understanding of gravitation was most spectacularly validated when it accurately presaged the return of Halley's Comet in 1758. Einstein's theory of relativity was vindicated in 1919 by the demonstration that light from distant stars is bent by the mass of the sun, just as predicted by the theory's equations. By the late 1970s, the theory of carcinogenesis proposed by Varmus and Bishop had also generated at least one such risky prediction. Varmus and Bishop had demonstrated that precursors of oncogenes, proto-oncogenes, existed in all normal cells. They had found activated versions of the SARC proto-oncogene in Rous sarcoma virus. They had suggested that mutations in such internal genes caused cancer. But a crucial piece of evidence was still missing. If Varmus and Bishop were right, then mutated versions of such proto-oncogenes must exist inside cancer cells. But thus far, although other scientists had isolated an assortment of oncogenes from retroviruses, no one had isolated an activated, mutated oncogene out of a cancer cell. Isolating such a gene, as the cancer biologist Robert Weinberg put it, would be like walking out of a cave of shadows. Where scientists had previously only seen oncogenes indirectly, they might see these genes in flesh and blood living inside the cancer cell. Robert Weinberg was particularly concerned with getting out of shadows. Trained as a virologist in an era of great virologists, he had worked in Dolbecko's lab at the Salk Institute in the 60s, isolating DNA from monkey viruses to study their genes. In 1970, when Temin and Baltimore had discovered reverse transcriptase, Weinberg was still at the bench, laboriously purifying genes out of monkey viruses. 6 years later, when Varmus and Bishop had announced the discovery of cellular SARC, Weinberg was still purifying DNA from viruses. Weinberg felt as if he was stuck in a perpetual penumbra, surrounded by fame but never famous himself. The retrovirus revolution, with all its mysteries and rewards, had quietly passed him by. In 1972, Weinberg moved to MIT, to a small laboratory a few doors down from Baltimore's lab, to study cancer-causing viruses. The chair of the department, he said, considered me quite a fool, a good fool, a hard-working fool, but still a fool. Weinberg's lab occupied a sterile, uninspiring space at MIT, in a 60s-style brutalist building served by a single creaking elevator. The Charles River was just far enough to be invisible from the windows, but just near enough to send freezing puffs of wind through the quadrangle in the winter. The building's basement connected to a warren of tunnels with airless rooms where keys were cut and machines repaired for other labs. Labs, too, can become machines. In science, it is more often a pejorative description than a complimentary one. An efficient, thrumming, technically accomplished laboratory is like a robot orchestra that produces perfectly pitched tunes but no music. By the mid-1970s, Weinberg had acquired a reputation among his colleagues as a careful, technically competent scientist, but one who lacked direction. Weinberg felt his work was stagnating. What he needed was a simple, clear question. Clarity came to him one morning in the midst of one of Boston's infamously blinding blizzards. On a February day in 1978, walking to work, Weinberg was caught in an epic snowstorm. Public transportation had ground to a halt, and Weinberg, in a rubber hat and galoshes, had chosen to plod across the blustering Longfellow Bridge from his home to his lab, slowly planting his feet through the slush. The snow blotted out the landscape and absorbed all sounds, creating a silent, hypnotic interior. And as Weinberg crossed the frozen river, he thought about retroviruses, cancer, and human cancer genes. SARC had been so easy to isolate and identify as a cancer-causing gene, Weinberg knew, because Rous sarcoma virus possesses a measly 4 genes. One could scarcely turn around in the retroviral genome without bumping into an oncogene. A cancer cell, in contrast, has about 20,000 genes. Searching for a cancer-causing gene in that blizzard of genes was virtually hopeless. But an oncogene, by definition, has a special property. It provokes unbridled cellular proliferation in a normal cell. Temin had used this property in his cancer-in-a-dish experiment to induce cells to form foci. And as Weinberg thought about oncogenes, he kept returning to this essential property. Of the 20,000 genes in a cancer cell, Weinberg reasoned the vast majority were likely normal, and only a small minority were mutated proto-oncogenes. Now imagine for a moment being able to take all 20,000 genes in the cancer cell, the good, the bad, the ugly, and transferring them into 20,000 normal cells, such that each cell receives one of the genes. The normal, unmutated genes will have little effect on the cells, but an occasional cell will receive an oncogene, and goaded by that signal, it will begin to grow and reproduce insatiably. Reproduced 10 times, these cells will form a little clump on a petri dish. At 12 cell divisions, that clump will form a visible focus, cancer distilled into its primordial elemental form. The snowstorm was Weinberg's catharsis. He had rid himself of retroviruses. If activated oncogenes existed within cancer cells, then transferring those genes into normal cells should induce these normal cells to divide and proliferate. For decades, cancer biologists had relied on Rous sarcoma virus to introduce activated sarc into cells and thereby incite cell division. But Weinberg would bypass Rous's virus. He would determine if cancer-causing genes could be transferred directly from cancer cells to normal cells. At the end of the bridge, with snow still swirling around him, he found himself at an empty intersection with lights still flashing. He crossed it, heading to the cancer center. Weinberg's immediate challenge was technical. How might he transfer DNA from a cancer cell to a population of normal cells? Fortunately, this was one of the technical skills that he had so laboriously perfected in the laboratory during his stagnant decade. His chosen method of DNA transfer began with a purification of DNA from cancer cells, grams of it precipitated out of cell extracts in a dense flocculent suspension, like curdled milk. This DNA was then sheared into thousands of pieces, each piece carrying one or two genes. To transfer this DNA into cells, he next needed a carrier, a molecule that would slip DNA into the interior of a cell. Here, Weinberg used a trick. DNA binds to the chemical calcium phosphate to form minuscule white particles. These particles are ingested by cells, and as the cells ingest these particles, they also ingest the DNA pieces bound to the calcium phosphate. Sprinkled on top of a layer of normal cells growing in a petri dish, these particles of DNA and calcium phosphate resemble a snow globe of swirling white flakes, the blizzard of genes that Weinberg had so vividly imagined in his walk in Boston. Once that DNA blizzard had been sprinkled on the cells and internalized by them, Weinberg envisioned a simple experiment. The cell that had received the oncogene would embark on unbridled growth, forming the proliferating focus of cells. Weinberg would isolate such foci and then purify the DNA fragment that had induced the proliferation. He would thus capture a real human oncogene. In the summer of 1979, Chiaho Shi, a graduate student in Weinberg's lab, began to barrel his way through 15 different mouse cancer cells, trying to find a fragment of DNA that would produce foci out of normal cells. Shi was laconic and secretive, with a slippery, quicksilver temper, often paranoid about his experiments. He was also stubborn. When he disagreed with Weinberg, colleagues recalled him thickening his accent and pretending not to understand English, a language he spoke with ease and fluency under normal circumstances. But for all his quirks, Shi was also a born perfectionist. He had learned the DNA transfection technique from his predecessors in the lab. But even more important, he had an instinctive feel for his cells, almost a gardener's instinct to discriminate normal versus abnormal growth. Shi grew enormous numbers of normal cells in petri dishes and sprinkled them weekly with genes derived from his panel of cancer cells. Plate after plate of transfected cells piled up in the laboratory. As Weinberg had imagined in his walk across the river, Shi soon stumbled upon a crucial early result. He found that transferring DNA from mouse cancer cells invariably produced foci in normal cells, proof that oncogenes could be discovered through such a method. In fact, the normal cells that Weinberg had used were not exactly normal. They were already growth-adapted, such that a single activated oncogene could tip them into transformed growth. Truly normal cells, Weinberg would later discover, require several genes to become transformed. Excited and mystified, Weinberg and Shi performed a bolder variant of the experiment. Thus far, they had been using mouse cancer cell lines to obtain their DNA. Changing tactics and species, they moved on to human cancer cells. If we were going to trap a real oncogene so laboriously, Weinberg recalled, we thought that we might as well find it in real human cancers. She walked over to the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute and carried back a cancer cell line derived from a patient, Earl Jensen, a long-term smoker who had died of bladder cancer. DNA from these cells was sheared into fragments and transfected into the normal human cell line. Shea returned to his microscope, scouring plate after plate for foci. The experiment worked yet again. As with the mouse cancer cell lines, prominent disinhibited foci appeared in the dishes. Weinberg pushed Shea to find the precise gene that could convert a normal cell to a cancer cell. Weinberg's laboratory was now racing to isolate and identify the first native human oncogene. He soon realized the race had other contenders. At the Farber, across town, Jeff Cooper, a former student of Temin's, had also shown that DNA from cancer cells could induce transformation in cells. So had Michael Wigler at the Cold Spring Harbor Lab in New York. And Weinberg, Cooper, and Wigler had yet other competitors. At the NCI, a little-known Spanish researcher named Mariano Barbacid had also found a fragment of DNA from yet another cancer cell line that would transform normal cells. In the late winter of 1981, all four laboratories rushed to the finish line. By the early spring, each lab had found its sought-after gene. In 1982, Weinberg, Barbacid, and Wigler independently published their discoveries and compared their results. It was a powerful, unexpected convergence. All three labs had isolated the same fragment of DNA, containing a gene called RAS, from their respective cancer cells. In fact, RAS, like SARC, had also been discovered earlier in a cancer-causing virus, again underscoring the striking capacity of these viruses to reveal the mechanisms of endogenous oncogenes. Like SARC, RAS was also a gene present in all cells. But like SARC again, the RAS gene in normal cells was functionally different from the RAS present in cancer cells. In normal cells, the RAS gene encoded a tightly regulated protein that turned on and off like a carefully modulated switch. In cancer cells, the gene was mutated, just as Varmus and Bishop had predicted. Mutated RAS encoded a berserk, perpetually hyperactive protein permanently locked on. This mutant protein produced an unquenchable signal for a cell to divide and to keep dividing. It was the long-sought native human oncogene, captured in flesh and blood out of a cancer cell. Once we had cloned a cancer gene, Weinberg wrote, the world would be at our feet. New insights into carcinogenesis and new therapeutic inroads would instantly follow. It was, as Weinberg would later write, all a wonderful pipe dream. In 1983, a few months after Weinberg had purified mutant RAS out of cancer cells, Ray Erickson traveled to Washington to receive the prestigious General Motors Prize for his research on SARC activity and function. The other awardee that evening was Tom Fry, being honored for his advancement of the cure for leukemia. It was a resplendent evening. There was an elegant candlelit dinner in a Washington banquet hall, followed by congratulatory speeches and toasts. Scientists, physicians, and policymakers, including many of the former Laskarites, gathered around linen-covered tables. The Laskarites had largely been disbanded in the aftermath of the 1971 National Cancer Act. Mary Lasker was still involved in science policy, although with nowhere near the force and visceral energy that she had summoned in the 60s. Talk turned frequently to the discovery of oncogenes and the invention of curative chemotherapy. but the two conversations seemed to be occurring in sealed and separate universes, much as they had at Temin's conference in Houston, more than a decade earlier. Fry's award for curing leukemia and Erickson's award for identifying the function of a critical oncogene might almost have been given to two unconnected pursuits. I don't remember any enthusiasm among the clinicians to reach out to the cancer biologists to synthesize the two poles of knowledge about cancer, Erickson recalled. The two halves of cancer, cause and cure, having feasted and been fated together, sped off in separate taxis into the night. The discovery of RAS brought one challenge to a close for cancer geneticists. They had purified a mutated oncogene from a cancer cell, but it threw open another challenge. Knudsen's two-hit hypothesis had also generated a risky prediction, that retinoblastoma cancer cells contained two inactivated copies of the RB gene. Weinberg, Wigler, and Barbacid had proved Varmus and Bishop right. Now someone had to prove Knudsen's prediction by isolating his fabled tumor suppressor gene and demonstrating that both its copies were inactivated in retinoblastoma. This challenge, though, came with an odd conceptual twist. Tumor suppressor genes, by their very nature, are asserted in their absence. An oncogene, when mutated, provides an on signal for the cells to grow. A tumor suppressor gene, when mutated, in contrast, removes an off signal for growth. Weinberg and Chiao Shi's transfection assay had worked because oncogenes can cause the normal cells to divide uncontrollably, thus forming a focus of cells. But an anti-oncogene, transfected into a cell, cannot be expected to create an anti-focus. How can one capture genes that behave like ghosts? Weinberg wrote, influencing cells from behind some dark curtain. In the mid-1980s, cancer geneticists had begun to glimpse shadowy outlines behind retinoblastoma's dark curtain. By analyzing chromosomes from retinoblastoma cancer cells using the technique pioneered by Janet Rowley, geneticists had demonstrated that the RB gene lived on chromosome 13. But a chromosome contains thousands of genes. Isolating a single gene from that vast set, particularly one whose functional presence was revealed only when inactive, seemed like an impossible task. Large laboratories professionally equipped to hunt for cancer genes, Webster Cavaney's lab in Cincinnati, Brenda Galley's in Toronto, and Weinberg's in Boston, were frantically hunting for a strategy to isolate RB. But these efforts had reached a standstill. We knew where RB lived, Weinberg recalled, but we had no idea what RB was. Across the Charles River from Weinberg's lab, Thad Dryja, an ophthalmologist turned geneticist, had also joined the hunt for RB. Dryja's laboratory was perched on the sixth floor of the Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary, the eyeball, as it was known colloquially among the medical residents. The ophthalmological infirmary was well known for its clinical research on eye diseases, but was barely recognized for laboratory-based research. Weinberg's Whitehead Institute boasted the power of the latest technologies, an army of machines that could sequence thousands of DNA samples, and powerful fluorescent microscopes that could look down into the very heart of the cell. In contrast, the eyeball, with its proud display of 19th-century eyeglasses and lenses in lacquered wooden vitrines, was almost self-indulgently anachronistic. Dryja, too, was an unlikely cancer geneticist. In the mid-1980s, having completed his clinical fellowship in ophthalmology at the infirmary in Boston, he had crossed town to the science laboratories at Children's Hospital to study the genetics of eye diseases. As an ophthalmologist interested in cancer, Dryja had an obvious target, retinoblastoma. But even Dryja, an inveterate optimist, was hesitant about taking on the search for RB. Brenda Galley and Webb Cavany had both stalled in their attempts to clone RB. It was a slow, frustrating time. Dryja began his hunt for RB with a few key assumptions. Normal human cells, he knew, have two copies of every chromosome, except the sex chromosomes, one from each parent. 23 pairs of chromosomes in all, a total of 46. Every normal cell thus has two copies of the RB gene, one in each copy of chromosome 13. Assuming Knudsen was right in his two-hit hypothesis, every eye tumor should possess two independent inactivating mutations in the RB gene, one in each chromosome. Mutations, Dryja knew, come in many forms. They can be small changes in DNA that can activate a gene, or they can be large structural deletions in a gene, stretching over a large piece of the chromosome. Since the RB gene had to be inactivated to unleash retinoblastoma, Dryja reasoned that the mutation responsible was likely a deletion of the gene. Deleting a sizable piece of a gene, after all, is perhaps the quickest, crudest way to paralyze and inactivate it. In most retinoblastoma tumors, Dryja suspected, the two deletions in the two copies of the RB gene would lie in different parts of the gene. Since mutations occur randomly, the chance of both mutations lying in precisely the same region of the gene is a little akin to rolling double sixes in dice that have 100 faces. Typically, one of the deletions would hit the front end of the gene, while the other deletion might hit the back end. In both cases, the functional consequences would be the same, inactivating RB. The two hits in most tumors would thus be asymmetric, affecting two different parts of the gene on the two chromosomes. But even 100-headed dice, rolled many times, can yield double sixes. Rarely, Dryja knew, one might encounter a tumor in which both hits had deleted exactly the same part of the gene on the two sister chromosomes. In that case, that piece of chromosome would be completely missing from the cell. And if Dryja could find a method to identify a completely missing piece of chromosome 13 in a retinoblastoma tumor cell, he would instantly land on the RB gene. It was the simplest of strategies. To hunt the gene with absent function, Dryja would look for absence in structure. To identify such a missing piece, Dryja needed structural mileposts along chromosome 13. Small pieces of DNA called probes, which were aligned along the length of the chromosome. He could use these DNA probes in a variant of the same sticking reaction that Varmus and Bishop had used in the 1970s. If the piece of DNA existed in the tumor cell, it would stick. If the piece did not exist, the probe would not stick, identifying the missing piece in the cell. Dryja had assembled a series of such probes. But more than probes, he needed a resource that he uniquely possessed, an enormous bank of frozen tumors. The chances of finding a shared deletion in the RB gene in both chromosomes were slim, so he would need to test a vast sample set to find one. This, then, was his crucial advantage over the vast professional labs in Toronto and Houston. Laboratory scientists rarely venture outside the lab to find human samples. Dryja, a clinician, had a freezer full of them. "I stored the tumors obsessively," he said with the childlike delight of a collector. "I put news out among patients and doctors that I was looking for retinoblastoma cases. Every time someone saw a case, they would say, 'Get that guy Dryja.' I would then drive or fly or even walk to pick up the samples and bring them here. I even got to know the patients by name. Since the disease ran in families, I would call them at home to see if there was a brother or sister or cousin with retinoblastoma. Sometimes I would know about a tumor even before doctors knew." Week after week, Dryja extracted the chromosomes from tumors and ran his probe set against the chromosomes. If the probes bound, they usually made a signal on a gel. If a probe was fully missing, the signal was blank. One morning, having run another dozen tumors, Dryja came to the lab and held up the blot against the window and ran his eyes left to right, lane after lane automatically, like a pianist reading a score. In one tumor, he saw